So your exhaustion isn't a scheduling problem.
Yeah, not at all.
It's actually it's an existential fracture. Today we're looking at why taking a week off work won't cure your burnout, mainly because your biology is literally at war with modern civilization.
Right. I mean, we've all been there.
Oh, absolutely. So if you're listening right now, have you ever felt like you're running on this treadmill that's just constantly speeding up, but you're somehow not getting anywhere?
Like your legs are moving, you're sweating, but
But the scenery never changes.
exactly.
You are completely drained, but you haven't actually moved an inch. So, welcome to today's deep dive into a really profoundly impactful document titled Burnout, Pace, and Fractal Awakening.
It's a fascinating text.
It really is. And we're going to explore why that feeling of endless, exhausting running isn't, a personal failing. It is a highly predictable symptom of a much larger civilizational crisis.
Yeah, that treadmill analogy you just used, that is the perfect entry point. Because what we are looking at today is a structural design flaw in how we live. It's not a weakness in your personal work ethic.
Exactly. So the mission of this deep dive is to basically completely deconstruct the modern epidemic of exhaustion. We're taking the research in front of us and we're going to examine it through four distinct lenses.
So we've got sociology, neuroscience, psychology, and esoteric philosophy.
Right. We are going to figure out the actual literal biology of burnout and how you can reclaim your life through a framework that the document calls a sacred pace.
Which is such a great term.
It really is. Okay,
Ugh.
let's unpack this. The opening premise of this document challenges almost everything we're taught about stress.
Oh, it completely upends it.
Right. It argues that we need to view burnout as a civilizational crisis rather than just like a sign that someone needs a vacation. So why? Why do we have to look at it as this massive systemic failure rather than just, hey, I've been logging too many hours, I need a nap?
Well, because treating burnout as an individual scheduling problem completely ignores the architecture of the crisis. I mean, when clinical framework
Like a World Health Organization,
Right.
right?
Yeah, exactly. Like the WHO's ICD-11. When they describe burnout merely as an occupational phenomenon,
Oh, right, a syndrome from chronic workplace stress.
right, workplace stress that hasn't been successfully managed, when they do that, they're looking at the smoke and entirely ignoring the fire.
Wow. Okay.
The underlying argument here is that the current global paradigm operates on a foundational ideology of infinite acceleration.
Infinite acceleration.
Yeah, it's an ideology of total domination. Domination over the natural world, over, temporal boundaries, and crucially, over human biological limits.
So we've basically built a civilization that demands individuals function as like optimized algorithms rather than living organisms.
Exactly. We are expected to be perpetually available, constantly producing, and relentlessly consuming.
But human beings aren't machines.
No, not at all. Life is not a mechanical process. It's a living, relational, fractal system defined by rhythmic cycles.
Right, cycles of expansion and contraction.
Exactly. So when you take a biological organism that physically requires periods of dormancy and you force it to live inside a mechanistic framework of infinite linear growth,
Friction.
yes, the friction that is generated doesn't just make you tired, it causes a profound psychological and physiological collapse.
Yeah.
Basically, it shatters the individual.
Okay, so that friction between our biology and our society, that's exactly where we need to start. And to understand the sociology of this trap, the text brings in a framework by philosopher Byung-Chul Han.
Yes, his work is incredible.
It really is. So he draws a really sharp contrast between the historical era of the disciplinary society and the modern era of the achievement society.
Right.
Let's break that down because I feel like it completely reframes how we view pressure. So in the past, under Michel Foucault's concept of the disciplinary society, life was based on negativity.
Yes, it was all about the mandate of should.
Right. So the disciplinary society was defined by hard, visible boundaries.
It was about prohibition, institutional walls, and external coercion. Think of like the quintessential institutions of the 19th and 20th centuries.
Like factories.
Factories, the prison, the barracks, the asylum. The driving force of society was negativity.
Meaning what you were strictly not allowed to do.
Exactly. The system produced obedient subjects. You were told exactly what your limits were by an external authority.
A boss, a warden, a commanding officer.
Right. And your job was simply to obey the rules within those confined physical spaces. If you do your 8 hours, you went home, and the authority stayed at the factory.
But Han argues that this paradigm is dead. Like, We don't live in that world anymore.
No, we really don't.
We have shifted into what he calls the achievement society. And instead of negativity and boundaries, this society is driven by relentless positivity.
Boundless potential.
Right, and the grammar of can.
Yeah.
So we've moved from you should do this to you can do anything, which, I mean, on the surface sounds amazing. People are constantly encouraged to act as entrepreneurs of themselves.
It sounds incredibly liberating.
Yeah.
And that is precisely what makes it so dangerously insidious. Han introduces this brilliant concept called the violence of positivity.
The violence of positivity. I love that phrase.
It's so accurate because there is no longer a tyrannical boss standing over you with a literal stick, right? Mm-hmm. The coercion has become entirely internalized.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The pressure to produce, to, you know, optimize your morning routine, to monetize your hobbies, to achieve it, has no external boundary.
So you are driving yourself beyond your biological and psychological limits entirely voluntarily.
Exactly.
Because it's framed as positivity. It's, you know, hustle. It's the grind. It's unlocking your limitless potential.
Right, exactly. This systemic pressure is practically invisible because it is socially celebrated.
Yeah, people applaud you for it.
I do. The violence of this system is highly efficient because you don't even realize you are being exploited.
Yeah.
You think you are self-actualizing.
It's like we used to be prisoners plotting an escape from the warden, but now we are simultaneously the prisoner and the warden.
That's a great way to put it.
We are constantly auditing our own worth based on our output. Like
yeah.
Every waking hour of the day is a performance review we are conducting on ourselves.
Yes.
But let me push back on this for a second, because I think a lot of people listening might feel defensive here.
Sure, yeah.
Isn't hustle culture genuinely empowering for a lot of people? Like when folks talk about being an entrepreneur of themselves, building a personal brand, or driving an Uber on the side, they talk about autonomy.
Right, being your own boss.
Exactly. They talk about building their own dreams instead of building someone else's. So how do we convince someone that this feeling of empowerment is actually a form of self-exploitation?
Well, that's the ultimate trap of the achievement society. And the proof lies in the pathologies it produces. What's fascinating here is how the data tracks the psychological fallout of these different eras.
Oh, okay, break that down.
So in the old disciplinary society, because the rules were external and rigid, the ultimate rebellion against those rules produced madmen and criminals. People acted out against the physical walls.
Because there was something to hit.
Exactly. But in the achievement society, because the pressure is internalized and there are no walls, you can't rebel against an external authority. You are the authority.
Right. There's no boss to yell at because you're the CEO of your own life.
Precisely. So when you inevitably fail to reach this impossible, theoretically infinite standard of productivity, you don't rebel outward. You turn inward. You rebel against yourself.
Oh, man.
Yeah. The Achievement Society doesn't produce revolutionaries. It produces depressives, the chronically exhausted and profoundly burned out individuals. It is a state of autoaggression.
Autoaggression, that's a chilling phrase.
It's accurate because your core identity is inextricably tied to your output. If your fundamental value as a human being is measured purely by what you can produce, and the cultural limit of what you can produce is always just over the horizon,
then you are perpetually falling short.
You exploit yourself until you burn out entirely. It leads to deep self-destruction and emptiness. You aren't empowered. You're just the most efficient, merciless slave driver you've ever had because you never let yourself clock out.
Wow. And this internalized psychological pressure doesn't exist in a vacuum. It is perfectly mirrored by the literal physical speed of the world around us.
Yeah, the macro reflects the micro.
Right. We are pushing ourselves internally while the external world is moving at warp speed. Let's look at the work of sociologist Hartmut Rosa, who outlines the theory of social acceleration.
Yes.
Rosa says there are three types of acceleration happening simultaneously.
Right. So first you have technical acceleration. That's the sheer quantifiable speed of communication, digital networks, and transportation. Data moves at the speed of light.
Okay.
Second, you have the acceleration of social change. This means the reliability of experiences, institutional knowledge, and societal expectations decay incredibly fast.
Like what was standard industry practice 5 years ago is entirely obsolete today.
Exactly. You can't rely on the skills you learned in college to carry you through a decade.
That makes sense.
And third, you have the acceleration of the overall pace of life itself. We are trying to cram more discrete episodes of action into every 24-hour cycle.
And there is this massive paradox here that I think everyone listening will immediately recognize. We have more technology explicitly designed to save time than any humans in history.
Right. High-speed internet, instantaneous global messaging.
AI doing our writing, algorithms doing our shopping. Yet temporal scarcity, that panicky feeling of having absolutely no time, is at an all-time high. Why? And if I just saved 4 hours using workflow automation software, where did those 4 hours go?
They get immediately consumed by the systemic demand for more growth.
Oh, of course they do.
Yeah. Rose explains this through a structural concept called dynamic stabilization.
Dynamic stabilization. Okay, what is that?
In modernity, our institutions, our economies, and our corporations must continually grow, innovate, and accelerate simply to maintain the status quo.
Wait, they have to grow just to stay in the same place.
Exactly. I like to think of it through the lens of the Red Queen hypothesis from evolutionary biology.
Oh, from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass.
Yes. The Red Queen tells Alice, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place.
Oh, wow.
In biology, species have to constantly adapt and evolve not to gain an advantage, but just to survive against ever-evolving predators and competitors.
Yeah.
Our economic system is the exact same way.
So if a modern corporation stops accelerating, if it just decides to maintain its current healthy profits without growing,
it doesn't just plateau safely, it gets devoured by competitors, it rapidly disintegrates.
So to not fall behind, to just stay exactly where we are, we have to run faster and faster. The baseline is constantly moving.
Yes, and this systemic macroeconomic mandate trickles down directly to the individual nervous system. The volume of emails, tasks, potential experiences, and media you could theoretically consume in a day far exceeds the finite amount of hours you have.
So the pressure to optimize every waking moment becomes crushing.
Rosa calls this condition the frenetic standstill.
The frenetic standstill, that's the treadmill feeling again. You are moving at blinding speed, you are exhausted, overwhelmed, and completely alienated from your own life, but fundamentally, nothing is changing.
You're just running to avoid collapse.
Right. And this brings up a fascinating secondary consequence of this high-speed society, which is the complete eradication of boredom.
Yes, this is a huge problem.
We are so terrified of stopping because stopping means falling behind that we exist in a permanent state of what the research calls hyperattention.
Hyperattention is characterized by a scattered, restless, highly vigilant focus. We are constantly shifting between tasks, checking notifications, jumping from one data point to another.
We avoid boredom at all costs.
Every empty moment, waiting in line, sitting on the toilet, riding the train, is immediately filled with shallow distractions and rapid media consumption.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I want to play devil's advocate regarding boredom. Culturally, we view boredom as a deeply negative state.
Yeah, as a failure to be productive or entertained.
Right. Isn't boredom just a lack of stimulation? Why do we actually need it to heal? Shouldn't we want to be engaged with the world? Like, if I have a free moment on the subway, why is reading an article on my phone or listening to an audiobook worse than just staring blankly at the wall of the train?
Well, because that constant, shallow engagement fundamentally erodes your biological capacity for deep, contemplative thought.
Really? Yeah. Just reading an article?
Yes. Boredom is not a void to be feared. It is the soul's breathing room. It's a biological necessity. When you are in a state of hyperattention, even if you were just casually scrolling or reading an article, your nervous system is still processing stimuli.
It's still taking in data.
Exactly. It is still consuming metabolic energy. Your brain is still working.
So even relaxing by scrolling is still work to the brain.
It is. Sacrificing boredom means you are killing your inner coherence. You are trapping yourself in a continuous cycle of superficial engagement that exhausts the mind without ever nourishing it. True creativity, philosophical inquiry, and most importantly, biological rest require a relaxed mental state that only occurs when you allow yourself to be entirely unstimulated for a period of time.
You have to let the mental waters settle so the sediment drops to the bottom, allowing you to see clearly.
That's a beautiful metaphor, yes.
Okay, so if we pull back sociologically, we are trapped. We are in a high-speed, self-exploitative loop. We are terrified of stopping because of dynamic stabilization. We are auditing our own worth based on infinite output, and we are systematically removing all the empty space, all the boredom out of our lives.
We have zero room to breathe.
Right, which naturally leads us to ask, how does the physical hardware of the human body handle this environment?
It doesn't. it catastrophically breaks down.
Right. And this takes us out of sociology and straight into the neuroscience of collapse.
What your brain actually looks like on burnout.
Exactly. Let's be clear. If you're listening, we are not talking about feeling sad or having a bad attitude about Monday mornings. We're talking about severe, measurable physical damage.
We absolutely must understand that burnout is a profound physiological dysregulation. The sociological demands of chronic urgency literally assault the biological architecture of the human organism.
So to understand this mechanism, we have to look at the biological architecture of stress.
Right, specifically what we can call the stress triangle in the brain.
Okay, so we're looking at three main structures here: the amygdala, the prefrontal cortex, and the hippocampus. Let's walk through how these are supposed to work under normal conditions.
So the amygdala is your primitive threat detection center, is the alarm bell of the brain.
Got it.
The prefrontal cortex is the highly sophisticated, evolutionarily newer part. It's responsible for executive function, sustained focus, rational decision-making, and emotional regulation.
So it's like the CEO.
Exactly, the CEO. And then the hippocampus manages learning, memory encoding, and putting experiences into spatial and temporal context.
Okay, so how do they interact when we get stressed?
Well, under acute short-term stress, say you're a hunter-gatherer and a predator jumps out of the brush, this system functions beautifully.
Right, the alarm goes off.
The amygdala spots the threat instantly and overrides the prefrontal cortex. It triggers the autonomic nervous system's sympathetic branch.
The famous fight-or-flight response. Now, we've all heard that term, but let's talk about what is physically happening in the body during that response, because it really sets the stage for the damage.
So during fight or flight, your body rapidly shifts its resources. It pulls blood away from your digestive tract and your immune system and pushes it into your major muscle groups so you can run or fight.
Which makes sense if there's a tiger.
Right. It releases a massive cascade of adrenaline and cortisol. This heavily heightens your immediate alertness, increases your heart rate, and spikes your blood sugar for immediate energy. It is an incredible survival mechanism.
But the key word there is immediate. It's designed to last for a few minutes. You either outrun the tiger or you don't.
Exactly. It is supposed to be incredibly acute, but the modern environment, the incessant digital notifications, the economic precarity, the constant performance reviews.
The achievement mandates we just talked about.
Yes. All of that traps the human organism in a state of chronic sympathetic dominance.
Meaning the gas pedal is permanently pressed to the floor.
Permanently. And when the perceived threat is constant, the brain begins to physically rewire itself in a highly maladaptive way to survive the constant flood of stress chemicals.
It changes the actual structure of the brain. And I mean, the data here is genuinely alarming. The amygdala, because it's constantly being activated by every email and Slack message, becomes hypertrophic.
It literally gets enlarged and becomes hyperreactive.
Right. It starts seeing danger everywhere. But while the amygdala grows, the other parts of the triangle shrink. Because your brain is flooded with sustained high levels of cortisol, the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus actually suffer volumetric shrinkage. They lose mass.
This is a crucial point, and we need to understand the mechanism of how this happens. Why does the brain shrink? It's about neurotoxicity.
Okay, explain that.
When cortisol levels remain elevated for weeks, months, or years, it overstimulates the glucocorticoid receptors in the hippocampus. This leads to a massive influx of calcium into the neurons.
And calcium is bad.
Too much calcium is toxic to the cell. It creates excitotoxicity. The neurons literally burn themselves out and die. And the dendritic connections, the branches that connect neurons together, shrivel up and retract.
Oh my God.
The brain cannibalizes its own tissue to protect itself from the overstimulation.
That is horrifying. You are biologically losing your ability to regulate emotions, plan for the future, and remember things contextually while your internal alarm bell is getting physically larger and more sensitive.
Yes. You are structurally becoming more anxious and less capable of dealing with that anxiety.
And the physical damage extends far beyond the brain, straight into the cardiovascular system, right?
Unfortunately, yes. Chronic anger, frustration, and high vigilance, which are hallmark emotions of the burnout spectrum, have a statistically significant negative effect on vascular endothelial health. The research specifically points out that it impairs endothelial-dependent vasodilation.
Okay, let's translate that. Endothelial-dependent vasodilation. What does that actually mean for the cardiovascular system of the person listening to this right now?
So the endothelium is the delicate single-cell inner lining of your blood vessels. Vasodilation is the ability of those vessels to widen and relax, allowing more blood to flow efficiently and reducing blood pressure.
It is how your cardiovascular system regulates itself.
Right. When you are in chronic sympathetic dominance, the chemical environment in your body, the constant adrenaline and cortisol, literally damages the ability of your blood vessels to relax.
They become stiff.
They do. Over time, this leads to chronic hypertension, increased plaque buildup, an incredibly heightened risk of heart disease, and it severely delays your physiological recovery from any illness or physical stress. Your blood vessels basically lose their elasticity.
The damage is completely systemic. But let's go even deeper into the brain's hardware, because the research looks at EEG data, the actual electrical activity of the brain, and the data on how burnout destroys coherent thought is staggering.
It really is.
The data shows that a high psychosocial load reliably reduces resting alpha power.
Alpha waves are critical. When you close your eyes and take a deep breath, your brain should produce alpha waves. They are the frequency of relaxed alertness and sensory gating.
Meaning they help the brain filter out irrelevant background noise.
Right. When you lose alpha power due to burnout, you lose the ability to sit calmly and just be alert without panicking. Every little sound, every notification startles you because your brain can no longer gate the sensory input.
And it gets worse when we look at how the brain communicates with itself. The dense array coherence mapping in the research shows that in cases of clinically verified burnout, the phase coupling severely breaks down. Specifically, the electrical synchronization between the right inferior frontal gyrus and long-range association cortices breaks down in the high alpha range, around 11 to 13 hertz.
The neurological fragmentation is profound.
Let me try an analogy to make this EEG data visual, because, I mean, phase coupling in the 11 to 13 hertz range sounds like abstract science fiction.
Please do.
Imagine your brain is a massive world-class symphony orchestra. The prefrontal cortex is the conductor standing at the front, keeping everyone in time.
Oh.
The phase coupling is the ability of the different sections of the orchestra to hear each other and play in sync. Under burnout, the conductor has left the building. The phase coupling breaking down means the violins can no longer hear the cellos.
That's spot on.
According to the data, burnout happens in a biphasic trajectory. The initial phase of burnout, this hyposynchronous tension phase, is like half the orchestra just falling asleep. Your theta, alpha, and low beta waves all drop. The music gets thin and weak. And then in the final exhaustion phase, it's like the brass section suddenly wakes up in a panic and just starts screaming uncontrollably. You get these low frequency theta rebounds in the center of the brain and high frequency beta flares in the temporal cortex.
That is an exceptionally accurate way to visualize the chaos of the burnout brain. You have low energy exhaustion mixed with high frequency panic.
High frequency panic, wow.
This profound electrical fragmentation is exactly why burned out individuals experience debilitating cognitive fatigue.
It's why you can't focus on complex tasks.
Why you read the same paragraph 5 times without absorbing a single word. And why you suffer from everyday memory failure, like losing your keys or forgetting a common word.
Because the hardware of the brain has literally lost its ability to synchronize. It cannot coordinate top-down attention.
Exactly.
Which is terrifying. The brain's electrical signals are essentially chaotic. But here is the major vital question we have to ask. If the physical hardware is broken, if the brain literally loses its ability to synchronize, if the hippocampus is shrinking and the blood vessels are stiffening, how can we physically fix this? How do we stop this cascade?
Well, if we look at this mechanically, the physical body is perfectly mirroring the sociological frenetic standstill we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The body is burning vast amounts of metabolic energy, firing off stress chemicals without making any functional progress.
Yeah.
If the sympathetic nervous system is the gas pedal we're permanently stuck on, we have to look for the brakes. And the biological brakes do exist.
We have just completely forgotten how to engage them.
Exactly.
So we know the gas pedal is the sympathetic nervous system. The brakes, according to the research, are found in the 10th cranial nerve, also known as the vagus nerve. This is the primary conduit for the parasympathetic nervous system, commonly known as the rest and digest network. Let's transition into the biology of recovery.
The vagus nerve is an extraordinary piece of biological architecture. It provides rapid bidirectional communication between your brainstem and nearly all your vital organs.
Your heart, lungs, spleen, liver, and gut.
Right. It is the biological handbrake.
Right.
When engaged, it lowers your heart rate, regulates your emotional responses, lowers systemic inflammation, and kicks off your physical recovery processes.
And the health and efficiency of this nerve is measured by something called vagal tone, which we can objectively assess through high-frequency heart rate variability, or HRV.
Yes.
Right. And the research notes that high vagal tone, meaning a strong, responsive vagus nerve, is strongly associated with stress resilience, emotional regulation, and cognitive control under pressure.
Absolutely.
This ties directly into the polyvagal theory and the Yerkes-Dodson law. Now, we shouldn't just name drop those. Let's explain how they work. The Yerkes-Dodson law is basically a bell curve of human performance, right?
Exactly. The Yerkes-Dodson bell curve shows that as stress or arousal increases, your performance and focus also increase up to a specific peak. You need a little bit of stress to be motivated.
Sure, otherwise you'd never get off the couch.
Right. But once you cross the peak of that bell curve, any additional stress causes a rapid, steep deterioration in performance. You become anxious, disorganized, and exhausted.
And polyvagal theory.
Polyvagal theory, developed by Dr. Stephen Porges, explains how our autonomic nervous system navigates this curve. It argues that we need a finely tuned balance between arousal, the sympathetic system, and calm, the parasympathetic system, via the vagus nerve, to stay at the peak of that curve.
But when you are burned out, your parasympathetic activity is drastically reduced. You have low vagal tone. You are sliding all the way down the bad side of the Yerkes-Dodson curve.
And when vagal tone drops, your body creates a vicious physiological feedback loop. Because the vagus nerve isn't signaling the heart and lungs to calm down, the brain assumes, well, my heart is racing, so the tiger must still be here.
Oh, man. So the body assumes it is still in mortal danger.
It feels perpetually unsafe, locked in survival mode. Your immune system weakens. Because the body thinks fighting a tiger is more important than fighting a cold.
Right.
Inflammation skyrockets and your emotional regulation plummets.
Okay, so if the vagus nerve is the brake and we desperately need to stop, why aren't we pressing it? Why is my heart still racing when I'm sitting in my living room?
Well,
this brings us to a huge psychological and biological disconnect. The research highlights a crucial fundamental difference between stressors and the stress response.
This is perhaps the most vital distinction to understand in modern psychology. A stressor is the external trigger in the world. It's the looming deadline, the angry email from your boss, the financial pressure, the traffic jam.
Okay.
The stress response, on the other hand, is the physiological and internal emotional state that your body enters into when faced with that stressor. It's the cascade of cortisol, the elevated heart rate, the widened pupils, the rapid breathing.
And a primary driver of modern burnout is our systemic failure to complete the biological stress cycle. We deal with the stressor, but we completely ignore the stress response.
Exactly.
So let's put the listener in a scenario to explain why this happens. Imagine it's Friday at 5 p.m. You have been agonizing over a massive high-stakes presentation all week. Your heart has been pounding.
Classic scenario.
Right. Finally, you hit send and submit the project. The stressor is unequivocally gone. You go home, you sit on the couch, and you turn on the TV. Why does the biological research say you are still physically in danger?
Because your central nervous system doesn't know what a spreadsheet is.
Right.
It doesn't understand what a deadline or an email is.
Yeah.
It only speaks the ancient language of biology. When you were dealing with that high-stakes project all week, your body interpreted that anxiety exactly as if you were being stalked by a physical predator.
It flooded your bloodstream with adrenaline and cortisol to help you survive.
When you hit send, the intellectual modern stressor vanished, but those survival chemicals are still coursing through your veins. The biological stress cycle has been activated, but it has not been completed.
And sitting passively on the couch watching TV doesn't complete the cycle.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Your body requires a physical somatic signal to know the threat has actually passed.
Like what?
Well, in the evolutionary wild, if you are chased by a predator and you outrun it, the massive physical exertion of running, followed by returning to the physical safety of your community and taking a deep breath, signals to the nervous system that you survived.
The cycle naturally closes.
But in the modern office, you sit perfectly still in an ergonomic chair while your body goes through a massive chemical life or death stress response.
Mm-hmm.
And because professional societal norms demand stoicism, you suppress any physical or emotional release. You don't run, you don't fight, you don't scream.
You just swallow it.
You swallow it. And when the stress cycle isn't closed through physical movement, deep social connection, creative expression, or emotional release, like a good, deep, shaking cry, that emotional exhaustion accumulates in your bodily tissues as a toxic residue.
The brain stays in sympathetic dominance.
Yes.
And the research makes a very sharp point here. This dynamic is heavily compounded by gendered and societal expectations.
Oh, heavily.
It specifically cites what sociologists call human giver syndrome. This is the deeply ingrained cultural construct that demands certain individuals, very often women, caregivers, nurses, teachers, parents, continually sacrifice their own energy, time, and emotional labor for the comfort and maintenance of others.
It's a critical intersection of biology and sociology. In human giver syndrome, the act of resting is culturally framed as a moral failure.
It's viewed as a sign of selfishness, laziness, or weakness.
This framework completely ignores that rest is a non-negotiable biological necessity for the human animal.
Let's apply this to a real scenario. Think about a working parent. They deal with the stress of the office all day, suppressing the stress cycle. They come home, and the societal expectation is that they must immediately pivot to being endlessly giving, patient, and emotionally available for their family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
These individuals are trapped in a perpetual, infinite stress response because they are never allowed by societal standards to prioritize the somatic release required to close the cycle.
They can't just drop everything.
Right. They cannot take an hour to aggressively exercise or emotionally decompress because they're expected to be providing care. They have to continually project an aura of calm and accommodation while their internal hardware is literally breaking down.
This physical inability to connect to biological safety, this trapping of toxic residue in the body, perfectly mirrors a psychological inability to connect meaningfully with the outside world.
It's all connected.
If you are biologically trapped, you become psychologically isolated. And this brings us to what the text calls the crisis of meaning in the digital age. We're moving from a physical breakdown of the nervous system to a spiritual and psychological breakdown. The text uses Hartmut Rose's dichotomy of alienation versus resonance to explain how we lose our connection to reality.
Rose's philosophical concepts are incredibly powerful tools for diagnosing modern misery. When we talk about alienation in this context, we aren't just talking about feeling a bit lonely on a Friday night.
Right.
Alienation is a structural condition. It occurs when the acceleration of life drastically outpaces your ability to meaningfully connect with your environment. The world around you becomes mute. It becomes hostile, silent, and purely instrumental.
Because you're just trying to survive the frenetic standstill. When you are in survival mode, everything is just a tool or an obstacle.
Precisely. You look at people, nature, and your work solely in terms of what you can extract from them, or what they can do to help you survive the day.
So the barista isn't a person. They're an obstacle between you and caffeine.
The natural landscape isn't a marvel. It's a blurry background out the window your commute.
The antidote to this profound alienation is resonance. Resonance is a vulnerable, bi-directional relationship with the world, with yourself, and with others. It is the absolute opposite of an extractive, transactional relationship.
Right.
The framework breaks down resonance into four crucial elements: affection, emotion, transformation, and unpredictability. Let's walk through these because they essentially define what it means to actually be alive rather than just mechanically functioning.
Sure.
First is affection. This is the capacity to be truly touched or moved by an encounter. It's not just seeing something happen, but feeling it physically impact your emotional state.
Okay.
Second is emotion, which the text refers to as responsive self-efficacy. This is the experience of a responsive, non-instrumental connection. You reach out to the world and the world responds to you, but not in a transactional input-output way.
Like a real conversation.
Right. Third is transformation. This is the willingness to be changed by an encounter. You don't leave a resonant interaction, whether it's a deep conversation, reading a profound book, or experiencing art as the exact same person you were when you entered it.
And the fourth element, unpredictability, is perhaps the most critical component when we look at our modern crisis.
How so?
True resonance possesses an intrinsic non-controllability. You cannot engineer it. You cannot schedule a calendar invite for a deeply moving conversation, or force a moment of awe in nature, or algorithmically generate a profound realization.
You can't put it on a spreadsheet.
You can only create the open conditions for it to occur, and then surrender to the mystery of it.
But the modern world, especially the digital ecosystem we spend 10 hours a day inside, is built entirely on the elimination of unpredictability.
Yes.
The research dives deep into digital overstimulation and how human attention is harvested as a commodity. We are living in a digital realm optimized by supercomputers for maximum engagement.
And these algorithms exploit our evolutionary psychological vulnerabilities, bombarding us with endless stimuli that trigger what the text calls microdoses of sympathetic arousal.
Right. Every ping, every red notification badge, every infinite scroll is a tiny hit to the amygdala.
And this creates a very specific modern form of digital burnout. You are engaging in constant rapid-fire communication without any genuine communion.
You have a massive network of connections, thousands of followers, hundreds of LinkedIn contacts, but without any true depth.
The digital fear hypermodulates our attention, keeping us locked in that scattered state of hypertension we discussed earlier, ensuring we are constantly consuming but never resonating.
It's what the text calls a disembodied digital existence. It gives us this godlike illusion of omnipresence. We can be in 100 Slack channels, 5 group chats, and 3 social media threads all at the exact same time, but we are truly physically present nowhere.
We are completely severed from the physical sensations of our somatic body and the natural rhythms of the earth.
And the irony here is just agonizing. The research highlights data on high-intent search queries. We have millions of people desperately Googling natural ways to reduce anxiety, or therapy clinic near me, or downloading mindfulness and wellness coaching apps. We are desperate for relief from the burnout.
But look at what we are doing. We are attempting to find salvation through the exact same digital optimization infrastructure that caused the burnout in the first place.
We're basically asking the poison to act as the antidote. We feel completely empty and exhausted by staring at our glowing rectangles all day. So we stare at our glowing rectangles at night to search for an app to teach us how to relax.
It's completely counterproductive.
We are using mechanistic tools to try and fix a biological and spiritual wound. But wait, let me push back here, because we have to be realistic. We can't just throw our phones into the ocean and go live in the woods.
No, of course not.
Society functions digitally. Our jobs, our families, our logistics, they are all online. And to its credit, the text explicitly says the solution isn't absolute rejection or becoming a Luddite, but rather conscious integration.
Yes.
What does that actually look like in practice? The text calls human attention the currency of the soul. What does it mean to consciously integrate if supercomputing algorithms are constantly trying to steal that currency?
Well, to understand conscious integration, we have to look back at the fourth element of resonance, unpredictability. We have to see the fundamental flaw in our current relationship with technology.
Okay.
Algorithms are designed by their very nature to predict and control human behavior. They want to serve you exactly what you will click on, ensuring a seamless, frictionless, entirely predictable, and highly monetizable user experience.
Right.
But true connection, awe, and deep realization require the unknown. They require friction. They require mystery. Because algorithms eliminate unpredictability, they inherently destroy resonance.
So what's the alternative?
Conscious integration means deliberately designing your digital architecture to leave room for silence and the unknown. It means refusing to let an algorithm curate your entire worldview. You have to treat your attention as a sacred currency, because what you focus your attention on literally expands to become your reality.
That's powerful.
If your attention is constantly fragmented across 1,000 algorithmically generated notifications, your mind becomes a scattered lens, utterly incapable of holding the deep, coherent focus required to heal your nervous system. You have to use technology as a finite tool with boundaries, not as an infinite environment that you live inside.
To escape this algorithmically controlled, mechanistic view of life, we can't just tweak our schedules or download a better app. We need a complete ground-up ontological paradigm shift.
We really do.
We have to fundamentally change how we view the very fabric of reality itself. And this is where the text takes us into the most profound and honestly the most challenging territory of the document, the philosophy of the fractal and the sacred pace.
This is the pivot point. This is where we shift from diagnosing the terminal illness of the Achievement Society to administering the cure.
So the research introduces an esoteric philosophical framework called Fractal the Trilogy. The core foundational premise here is that reality is not a fixed, solid, dead machine to be conquered, optimized, and dominated by human will.
No, it is a relational, fluid, recursive projection of consciousness. It is a multidimensional living membrane.
Right. The universe operates through fractal geometry. Patterns reflect and repeat across scales. We see this everywhere in nature. The microscopic branching architecture of the neurons in your brain looks exactly like the branching of trees in a forest, which looks exactly like the macroscopic branching spirals of galaxies.
Exactly.
Reality is not a straight line moving infinitely upward on a graph. It is cyclical and recursive. And to explain how we fit into this, the philosophy introduces a metaphor called the Trinity Monument. I want to make sure we ground this because it gets very abstract. How does this Trinity Monument explain reality?
So the Trinity Monument consists of three interconnected layers of existence. First, you have the source, or spirit. This is the unmanifested origin of all things, the pure potentiality.
Okay, that's layer one.
Second, you have global consciousness, which acts as the informational field of infinite potential timelines and awareness. It's the collective mind.
And layer three.
And third, you have the space-time membrane. This is the physical, tangible world. It is the unfolding playground of physical experience where we actually live out these timelines in our bodies.
The text gets incredibly cosmic here, bringing in astrophysics to explain human consciousness. It mentioned that dark matter isn't just an inert, empty void between stars. It acts as the connective tissue of awareness across the cosmos.
It posits that black holes are evolutionary gateways where physical information is reflected back into the whole.
And humanity, biologically, is made of the heavy elements forged in stellar collapses. We literally carry the memory and the physical material of the cosmos within our bones. Now, if I'm listening to this on my commute, I might be asking, this is beautiful poetry, but what does this esoteric cosmic philosophy have to do with my burnout at the marketing firm?
Right, it seems disconnected.
But the answer, according to the text, lies in the illusion of separation.
Exactly. The bridge between the cosmic and the cubicle is the concept of control. The modern burnout crisis stems directly from the human ego's ancient hunger for control, permanence, and boundless accumulation.
The achievement society demands linear, endless, uninterrupted growth. Your quarterly profits must always be higher than the last quarter. Your productivity must always increase.
But as this fractal philosophy points out, linear, endless growth is an unnatural, cancerous aberration in a fractal cosmos.
The universe is defined by organic cycles, expansion and contraction, birth and death, summer and winter, action and rest. When human systems, like our corporate economic structures and our daily work routines, attempt to force a linear, infinite progression onto a cyclical, biological reality, the resulting friction shatters the individual.
It breaks us.
Let me use an analogy here to make that friction tangible. Trying to live a linear life of constant, permanent, 100% growth in a fractal, cyclical universe is like trying to swim endlessly in one direction in a massive whirlpool.
Yeah, I like that.
You can fight the current, you can hustle, you can optimize your swimming strokes, you can drink caffeine to swim harder, but eventually the sheer physical friction of fighting the natural rotation of the water is going to tear your muscles apart. That tearing apart is burnout.
You are exhausted because you are fundamentally fighting the foundational rhythm of reality itself. That is a brilliant way to frame it.
Thanks.
And this is why the framework radically redefines the concept of stillness.
Mm-hmm.
In a high-speed achievement society, stillness is feared. It's viewed as laziness, or it becomes the paralyzed, frenetic standstill where you are just stuck and overwhelmed.
But in the fractal paradigm?
In the fractal paradigm, true stillness is the presence of the real. It is the quiet, eternal center around which the chaotic storm of reality rotates. Returning to this profound stillness is the only way to genuinely recalibrate your nervous system.
Wow.
The framework argues that the mind reflects and narrates, but it is deeper consciousness that actually creates. You have to allow the anxious narrating mind to step aside so that deeper intuitive biological wisdom can emerge from the space between your thoughts.
Which brings us finally to the blueprint. The source codifies this entire massive paradigm shift, synthesizing the sociology of Hahn and Rosa, the neurobiology of the vagus nerve and brain shrinkage, and the fractal philosophy into a highly actionable 7-step framework called the Sacred Pace.
This is how you actually live this out in the real world.
Let's take our time and walk through these 7 steps because okay. This is the cure. Okay, so if we take this fractal philosophy seriously, the framework lays out a very specific sequence for recalibration. The first thing that jumps out is step one, rhythm awareness and fractal alignment.
This first step demands a complete audit of how we measure time. It asks us to map our lives and our labor, not to mechanical clocks, server uptimes, or industrial quotas, but to biological and natural cycles.
Right.
It means honoring your circadian rhythms and acknowledging that human physical and cognitive energy naturally waxes and wanes throughout the day, the month, and the year. You are a biological organism.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot operate at 100% capacity year-round without breaking.
So periods of deep dormancy are biologically required to sustain periods of high output?
Yes. You have to start using your physical body as a compass, listening to its signals, rather than treating it as a stubborn machine that you have to whip into submission.
Which leads directly into step two, intentional rest and closing the stress cycle. We talked about the biology of this earlier, but here it is operationalized as a daily practice. In the achievement society, rest is viewed as a conditional reward for productivity. You earn the right to rest only by finishing your to-do list.
But here's the trap. The to-do list is infinite. It will never be finished. Therefore, you never earn rest.
This step mandates that rest is a foundational, non-negotiable biological requirement, like breathing. You have to actively and intentionally close the stress cycle every single day through somatic release, whether that's intense movement, deep physical connection, or emotional expression.
The text uses a powerful phrase here. Rest is resistance in a world that worships speed.
Rest is resistance. That's incredible.
Choosing to rest is a radical act of reclaiming your humanity from the machinery of the achievement society.
And that somatic release leads us to step three, recovery rituals and nervous system regulation. This is about taking the neurobiology we discussed and putting it into practice.
Yes, you must specifically target that vagus nerve to reverse the structural damage of chronic sympathetic dominance and stop the shrinking of your hippocampus.
You cannot just think your way out of burnout. You have to breathe your way out of it.
Exactly. This means integrating deliberate vagal stimulation into your daily life. Specific extended exhale breathwork protocols, mindfulness, and crucially immersive time in natural environments.
The text beautifully notes, the earth heals in ways the mind cannot.
Yes. When you physically ground your body in nature, the fractal patterns of the trees and the unstructured sensory input physically signal biological safety to your hyperactive amygdala. This allows your prefrontal cortex to come back online and resynchronize the brain's electrical activity.
Okay, so we are aware of our rhythms, we are resting, and we are regulating our nervous system, but we still have to interact with the modern world. That brings us to step four, values-based scheduling and the cultivation of resonance.
This requires a violent shift in our time management philosophy. The goal of a calendar is no longer maximizing efficiency and output. The goal is maximizing resonance and meaning.
You have to ruthlessly prune your life. You have to prioritize activities, environments, and relationships that foster those four elements of resonance: deep affection, emotional responsiveness, transformation, and unpredictability. You have to protect your capacity to be moved by the world.
But let me bring in some real-world friction here because I think it's important.
Go for it.
Values-based scheduling sounds great if you are a wealthy tech executive on a retreat.
Mm-hmm.
What about a single parent working a minimum wage shift job? How realistic is it to tell them to maximize resonance when they are just trying to pay the electric bill?
It is a vital critique, and the framework doesn't pretend to wave a magic wand over systemic poverty. However, values-based scheduling at its core isn't about luxurious vacations or abandoning responsibilities. It is about micro-reclamations of agency.
Right.
It is about fiercely protecting whatever tiny margins of time you do have. If you have 15 minutes of a commute, do you use it to algorithmically numb yourself with social media, or do you use it to listen to music that deeply moves you?
Do you use a 10-minute break to frantically check emails, or do you close your eyes and do a vagal breathing exercise to signal safety to your body?
Exactly. It is about shifting the intent of your time, reclaiming your internal environment even when your external environment is highly constrained.
Reclaiming the margins. I love that. And addressing those systemic constraints is exactly why the framework moves from the individual to the organizational level in step five, coherent leadership and systemic compassion.
Right. This step argues that leadership paradigms, whether in a corporation, a hospital, or a family, must shift from demanding boundless extraction to actively fostering psychological safety.
Coherent leadership recognizes the biological reality that humans are not algorithms. It balances the emotional labor of the team, respects temporal boundaries as structural necessities rather than perks, and actively rejects the normalization of human giver syndrome.
And coherent leadership is directly tied to step six, slower decision cadence. This step argues that in an era of hyperacceleration where the social and technical speed is blinding, deliberately slowing down decision-making is a strategic necessity.
If you don't slow down, you are simply reacting purely out of the fear centers of the brain, driven by the amygdala.
This is the step that I think will get the most aggressive pushback from the business world. Let's be brutally real here. How can slower decision cadence and coherent leadership realistically survive in today's cutthroat, hyper-capitalist corporate world?
It's the most common and logical pushback to this entire philosophy, but it rests on a fundamentally flawed assumption. It assumes that maximum speed equals long-term efficacy. The data and the biology prove otherwise.
So speed isn't efficacy?
No. The research argues that continuous infinite growth based on hyperacceleration is biologically and structurally unsustainable. Systems that operate on pure, unchecked acceleration eventually, inevitably collapse, just like the human cardiovascular system and the hippocampus under chronic burnout.
Oh, I see the connection.
Right. The competitor running at blinding speed is generating immense friction. They are experiencing massive employee turnover, degraded cognitive function in their leadership, and a complete loss of creative resonance. They are in the frenetic standstill.
Coherent leadership isn't about being weak or passive. It is a structural necessity for long-term survival. When you operate from a slower cadence, you invite deep intuition, profound contemplation, and superior analytical processing from the prefrontal cortex.
You stop reacting to the blind panic of dynamic stabilization and start acting from a grounded, strategic center. The framework makes a bold claim here. It argues that deep presence actually bends the world.
Presence bends the world.
Yes. When an organization operates with true biological coherence, it generates sustainable, highly resilient innovation that easily outlasts the frantic, inevitable collapse of its hyper-accelerated competitors.
So the turtle doesn't just win the race. The hare dies of a heart attack halfway through.
Exactly.
That leads us perfectly to the final culmination of the framework, step 7, designing life around presence. This is the ultimate recognition that the present moment is the only actual intersection of time and eternity. Designing your life around presence means treating your attention as your most sacred currency.
It means flatly refusing to fracture your mind across endless digital voids. It is the daily practice of being fully physically embodied, allowing your physical senses to act as gateways to the immense depth of ordinary experience.
The goal here isn't to escape the fractal universe or transcend physical reality out of a fear of burnout. The goal is to awaken within the dream, to participate as a conscious, resilient co-creator of your own life.
Ultimately, the sacred pace is about abandoning the exhausting path of domination and mechanical control and stepping onto the path of biological alignment and deep empathy. It is the only scientifically and spiritually viable way to navigate the flow of modern existence without tearing yourself apart.
So if we stop acting like broken machines and start recognizing ourselves as living, breathing parts of a cyclical cosmos, what is the ultimate takeaway for you, the listener? We have gone incredibly deep today.
We really have.
We've seen how the sociology of the achievement society tricked us into highly efficient self-exploitation, masking it under the guise of empowerment.
We've looked at the terrifying neuroscience of how our brains literally cannibalize their own memory centers and how our blood vessels stiffen from the chronic urgency of uncompleted stress cycles.
And we've seen how digital algorithms systematically stole our capacity for true resonance, substituting deep, unpredictable connection for addictive microdoses of anxiety. The most important thing you can take away from this is this. Burnout is not your fault.
It is not a failure of your work ethic.
It is the highly predictable, inevitable biological symptom of trying to live mechanically inside a living cosmos. Your attention is your most sacred currency, and reclaiming it from the machine is an act of profound spiritual and biological resistance.
Well said.
Before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a provocative final thought to mull over, building on this idea of resonance and unpredictability. If the digital world traps our nervous systems because algorithms fundamentally eliminate unpredictability,
right.
And if the modern achievement society violently demands that every single action have a monetizable, productive output, then what is the antidote? What if the most radical, restorative act you can do tomorrow isn't downloading a new meditation app or buying a new planner or perfectly optimizing your sleep routine?
What if it's simpler than that?
Exactly. What if the ultimate biological cure for burnout is intentionally doing something completely unscripted, utterly unoptimized, and totally useless, just to prove to your panicked nervous system that you are still a living human being and not a machine? Go outside, find a weird rock, and just stare at it for 10 minutes. Let things be murky for a while. Embrace the messy, organic, unpredictable reality that an X-ray can never quite capture.